sleep-a-time facts, orbital physics. Settle into a comfortable position and let your breathing become slow and even. Orbital physics begins with a simple idea. Objects move through space along paths shaped by gravity. When a smaller body circles a larger one, it is following a curve made by attraction and motion. The moon travels around Earth in this quiet way, and Earth moves around the sun with steady, predictable rhythm. There is no strain in these motions. An orbit can be nearly circular, or it can be a gentle oval. The same natural rules guide satellites and planets alike. Each path is balanced, repeating, and calm. As you rest, you can imagine these slow, orderly movements as soft circles in the dark. Nothing is rushing. Everything follows its course. All of it is guided by the same patient pull. Planets do not wander without pattern. Their paths repeat in smooth curves. And the first clear description of those curves came from three statements about motion. Those statements describe how a body moves around another body under steady attraction. They apply to planets around stars and to moons around planets. Small natural objects moving in quiet space follow the same geometry. The first statement says that an orbit is an ellipse. An ellipse is a closed oval shape. It can be drawn by fixing two points, called foci, and keeping the total distance from those two points the same. A circle is a special ellipse where the two foci meet at the center. In a planetary orbit, the star sits at one focus. The other focus is empty. This means the planet is not always the same distance from its star. There is a nearest point and a farthest point, and the line through those points is the long axis of the ellipse. Half of that long axis is called the semimajor axis, and it gives a useful measure of the size of the orbit. For many planets, the ellipse is close to a circle. The difference between nearest and farthest distance can be small. So the path looks round in simple diagrams. The shape is still an ellipse, though, and the small difference matters when positions are measured carefully. Kepler reached this idea after comparing many observations with models that used perfect circles. The circular models came close, but they did not match the records at every point. An ellipse fit the pattern better. The second statement describes speed along the path. A planet does not move at one unchanging rate. If a line is drawn from the planet to the star, that line sweeps out area as the planet moves. In equal spans of time, the swept area is equal. When the planet is closer to the star, the line is shorter. So the planet must cover more distance along its path to sweep the same area. It moves faster when the planet is farther away. The line is longer, and the motion is slower. The change is smooth and regular. There is no sudden start or stop, only a steady exchange between distance and speed. This rule gives the orbit a kind of balance. A planet near its star spends less time moving quickly through that part of the path. A planet far from its star spends more time moving slowly through the wider arc. The areas match, so the timing remains orderly. Later physics showed that this pattern follows from the conservation of angular momentum. The idea is that a moving body keeps a certain amount of rotational motion unless something outside changes it. Kepler did not need that later explanation to state the rule. He found it by watching how positions changed over time. The third statement connects the size of an orbit to the time needed to complete it. For bodies orbiting the same star, the square of the orbital period is proportional to the cube of the semimajor axis. In plain terms, a planet farther from its star takes longer to go around, and the relationship follows a fixed mathematical pattern. The law does not say that all orbits take the same time. It says that distance and period are tied together in a reliable way. A small change in average distance brings a predictable change in the length of a year. This third law gives a sense of scale to a planetary system. If the period of one planet is known, and the period of another is known, their relative distances can be compared. The law does not require knowing the exact size of the system in miles or kilometers. It can compare one orbit with another. That made it useful for mapping the arrangement of planets long before distances could be measured directly by modern methods. These three statements came from patient work with observations. Astronomers had watched the sky for generations, recording where planets appeared among the stars. The records included slow drifts and pauses, along with occasional backward loops, as seen from Earth. Those loops happen because Earth and the other planets are moving at different rates around the sun. To understand the true shape of the paths, someone had to separate the motion of Earth from the motion of the other bodies. Kepler worked with a large set of careful measurements and tested many possible paths. The final result was not a single sudden guess. It was a long comparison of geometry with repeated observations. The first law gave the shape. The second law gave the pace. The third law tied one orbit to another. Together, they form a complete description of simple orbital motion. They do not explain the force behind the motion. That explanation came later with gravity. Newton showed that an inverse square attraction naturally produces elliptical paths, and the timing rule Kepler had found. Still, the three laws remain useful on their own. They describe the motion without needing the cause. Their reach is wider than planets. Moons follow the same general pattern around planets. Artificial satellites follow similar paths around Earth or other bodies. When a spacecraft coasts through space with its engines quiet, its path can often be described with the same geometry. The closed ellipse is the shape of a bound orbit. Other conic curves describe paths that pass by once and do not return. Kepler's first law is usually stated for ellipses, but the underlying shape belongs to a larger family. The same careful attention to form and timing applies. The laws also help separate appearance from reality. From the ground, a planet seems to move against the background stars in a complicated way. Part of that motion comes from the planet itself, and part comes from the observer moving with Earth. Once the orbit is understood as an ellipse with a regular speed pattern, the apparent wanderings become easier to predict. The sky becomes less confusing. The same methods can be applied to any body whose position is measured over time. A spacecraft passing near a planet is not simply pulled inward and then released. It moves through the gravity of a body that is itself traveling around the sun. That motion is what gives the encounter its special value. The planet's gravity bends the spacecraft's path. The planet's orbital motion can add a small amount of speed to the spacecraft when the two are viewed from the sun. The result is a quiet exchange of momentum carried out across millions of kilometers without contact and without noise. In the frame of reference that moves with the planet, the encounter has a simple shape. The spacecraft approaches along a curved path. It swings around the planet and leaves along another curved path. If the engines are off and no other force interferes, the speed relative to the planet is the same before and after the pass. Gravity changes the direction of the velocity, not its magnitude in that local frame. The path is usually a hyperbola, open at both ends, with the planet sitting at one focus. The spacecraft never needs to touch the atmosphere or the surface. It only needs to pass close enough for the bend to be useful. From the sun's point of view, the situation looks different. The planet is moving along its orbit while the spacecraft is being deflected. Because the exit direction has been rotated, the spacecraft's velocity combines with the planet's orbital velocity in a new way. If the spacecraft leaves the encounter, moving more nearly in the direction of the planet's orbit, its speed around the sun increases. If it leaves moving more against that direction, its solar speed decreases. The same basic flyby can therefore be arranged to speed a spacecraft up or to slow it down. This is often described as a gravity assist. Because the spacecraft gains useful velocity without firing its engine for the main change, the word assist is gentle and accurate. The planet does not give away energy in a dramatic way. It simply shares a tiny part of its enormous orbital momentum. Since the planet is so massive compared with any probe, the change in the planet's own motion is far too small to notice. The spacecraft, being much lighter, receives a meaningful change in speed and direction. Conservation of momentum remains intact throughout. The idea follows from treating motion in two frames at once. When a trajectory is drawn relative to a planet, the flyby looks symmetric. When the same path is viewed from the sun, the planet's motion adds a shift to that symmetry. Recognizing that shift allowed mission planners to treat flybys as useful tools rather than chance events. The geometry of the pass determines the outcome. A spacecraft that passes behind a planet, meaning on the trailing side of the planet's motion around the sun, tends to be pulled forward and leaves with more speed around the sun. A spacecraft that passes ahead of the planet tends to be held back slightly and leaves with less. Engineers choose the approach path so that the desired change appears naturally. As the spacecraft coasts through the encounter, small course corrections made earlier can place the spacecraft on the right line for the flyby. A gravity assist can also turn the direction of travel. Reaching some destinations requires more than extra speed. The trajectory may need to tilt or line up with another moving target. A well-chosen flyby can bend a path toward a planet farther out or angle it upward relative to the flat plane, where most planets orbit. This makes it possible to design routes that would require much more fuel if the spacecraft had to make every change by thrust alone. The assist uses the steady pull of gravity to reshape the orbit. The encounter itself follows ordinary orbital mechanics. As the spacecraft approaches, the planet's gravity grows stronger. The craft accelerates toward the planet. After reaching its closest point, it recedes. The speed relative to the planet rises as it falls inward and falls again as it moves away. At the end, the outgoing speed matches the incoming speed in the view centered on the planet. The angle through which the path bends depends on how close the spacecraft comes and how fast it is moving. A closer pass produces a larger turn, while a more distant pass produces a gentler one. Mission planners often string several assists together. A spacecraft can visit one planet and receive a nudge in velocity. It can then coast toward another body that is positioned favorably. Each encounter can alter the orbit's height or tilt. The spacecraft spends most of its time in steady free fall between planets. The flybys serve as carefully timed points where the existing motion of the solar system does part of the traveling. This is one reason probes can reach distant regions with limited fuel. The energy accounting is calm and exact. In the frame of the sun, the spacecraft may leave with more kinetic energy than it had before the encounter. That extra energy is balanced by an equally real decrease in the planet's orbital energy. The planet slows by an amount so small that it is lost in the natural scale of its motion. The spacecraft gains a practical advantage from the exchange. No violation occurs. The total energy and momentum of the interacting bodies remain conserved, with gravity acting as the medium of transfer. Gravity assists are not limited to speeding outward journeys. They can help a spacecraft slow down when arriving at a destination. By passing a planet in the proper orientation, a probe can reduce its speed relative to the sun and make it easier to enter orbit later. The same principle can be used to adjust the timing of a mission, allowing a spacecraft to arrive at a target when conditions are suitable. The method gives navigators a way to work with the solar system rather than against it. The predictability of these encounters is part of their usefulness. The motions of planets are stable and well measured. Once a trajectory is chosen, the gravitational interaction can be calculated with high precision. Spacecraft teams track the approach and compare it with predictions. Small corrections can be made when needed. The flyby itself does not require sudden action. It unfolds as a smooth curve, governed by the same equations that describe the motion of planets and comets. There is a quiet elegance in using a moving planet to guide a small machine. The spacecraft does not force its way across space. It follows a path shaped by mass and motion, arriving at the right place to receive a slight change in velocity. The planet continues on its ancient orbit, unaware in any human sense, yet offering a reliable current for travel. Gravity assists turn distance into something that can be crossed with patience and careful aim. between two orbiting bodies. There are positions where the pull of gravity and the motion of the rotating frame line up in a steady way. A small object placed near one of these positions can remain in a fixed relationship with the larger bodies. These positions are called Lagrange points. They arise from the same simple fact that governs all orbital motion. Gravity depends on distance, and motion carries an object forward, while gravity curves its path. In a system with two large bodies, such as the Sun and Earth, or Earth and the Moon, each body pulls on everything nearby. A spacecraft feels both pulls. It also has its own motion. If the spacecraft is in the right place and moving at the right rate, the combined effects can repeat in a regular pattern. In a view that turns with the two large bodies, the spacecraft can appear almost still. That is the central idea behind a Lagrange point. There are five such points in a two-body system. They are labeled lone through L5. The first three lie along the line that joins the two large masses. Lone sits between them. L2 lies beyond the smaller body, away from the larger one. L3 rests on the far side of the larger body, opposite the smaller one. The other two points form equilateral triangles with the large bodies. L4 leads the smaller body along its orbit, and L5 trails it by the same angular distance. The line points are often described as places of balance, but they are not stable in the same way a bowl is stable. A marble at the bottom of a bowl returns after a small push. A marble balanced on a hilltop rolls away. The three line points behave more like the hilltop. If an object drifts too far from one of these points, the drift tends to grow unless small corrections are made. Spacecraft stationed near them usually do not sit exactly on the point. They follow slow loops around it, called halo orbits or Lesagus orbits, and they use modest adjustments to remain in the desired region. The triangular points are different. L4 and L5 can be stable when the two large bodies have a sufficiently unequal mass. As with a star and a planet, or a planet and a large moon. In that case, an object near the point can stay nearby for long periods. The motion is not perfectly still. The Coriolis effect helps bend small departures into looping paths, and the object tends to trace a gentle course around the point, guided by the combined gravity of the two bodies. This stability is why natural material can gather there. Some planets have small asteroids or dust clouds near the triangular points of their orbits. The mathematics behind these points comes from studying motion in a rotating frame. In ordinary space, an object moves under gravity alone. In a frame that rotates with two orbiting bodies, a centrifugal effect appears in the equations, acting like an outward tendency associated with the rotation. The problem becomes finding places where the inward gravitational pulls and the rotational effect allow a small object to keep the same relative position. The solution yields five locations. The result was worked out in the broader study of celestial mechanics, where mathematicians sought patterns in the motion of planets and moons. The name most closely associated with the five points is Joseph Louis Lagrange. Though the idea grew from a long tradition of analyzing gravity and motion, a useful way to picture Lone is to imagine a point between the sun and Earth where a spacecraft can maintain an uninterrupted view of the sun because it stays near the line connecting the two bodies. It can observe solar activity without being blocked by Earth. Such a position also allows steady measurements of the solar wind before it reaches our planet. The spacecraft does not remain perfectly motionless. It circles around the point, while the whole arrangement moves with Earth around the sun. Eltwo, on the other side of Earth from the sun, offers a different kind of steadiness. A telescope placed near this point can keep the sun on one side, while Earth and the moon remain near that same direction. That makes it easier to shield sensitive instruments from heat and light while looking outward into deep space. The point itself is not a parking spot with a fixed address. It is a region where careful motion can be maintained with modest effort. Earth and the moon also have Lagrange points. Because the moon is much closer than the sun, the geometry is different, but the same principles apply. Some proposals for space facilities have suggested using these points because they can serve as stable waypoints for communication or observation. The triangular points of the Earth-Moon system may provide places where small amounts of dust can linger, though they are less crowded with natural objects than some planetary examples. Not every Lagrange point is equally useful for every task. A point that is good for watching the sun may not be good for looking at the distant universe. A point that is naturally stable may be too far from Earth for routine service. Mission planners choose locations based on what a spacecraft needs to observe and how it will communicate with home. The amount of fuel available also shapes the choice. The points provide options, not universal answers. The idea of a balance of forces can sound like stillness, but these regions are better understood as patterns of motion. Gravity is always present. The bodies are always moving. The spacecraft or dust grain at a Lagrange point is moving too. What remains steady is the relationship among the participants. The small object shares the rhythm of the larger system. One quiet feature of these points is that they reveal how gravity can organize space without any solid structure. There are no markers or physical platforms. The order comes from mass and distance, joined with motion. When a spacecraft settles into a loop near one of these points, it is following a path shaped by the same forces that guide planets around the sun and moons around planets. A clear natural example is found with Jupiter. Large groups of asteroids share the planet's orbit around the sun. Gathered near the leading and trailing triangular points, these objects are often called Trojans. They are not packed closely together. The distances between them are usually great, but their presence shows that the triangular points can keep material associated with a planet for long spans of time. High above the equator, there is a distance where an object can circle Earth once in the same time. Earth turns once beneath it. At that distance, gravity and orbital speed fit together so neatly that a satellite returns to the same place in the sky after each rotation of the planet. To a person standing on the ground with a dish aimed upward, the satellite can seem almost still. A quiet point hanging over one longitude while the surface moves below. This is the meaning of a geosynchronous orbit. The term refers to an orbit whose period matches the rotation of Earth. The match is made with the sidereal day, the time Earth needs to turn once relative to distant stars. That interval is a little shorter than the common day of clocks, because Earth is also moving along its path around the sun. A satellite timed to the sidereal day keeps pace with the turning planet rather than with the sun's apparent return to the sky. If the path is circular, lies over the equator, and follows the direction of Earth's spin, the satellite remains above the same equatorial point. That special case is called a geostationary orbit. All geostationary orbits are geosynchronous, but the reverse is not true. A satellite with a tilted or slightly stretched path still repeats its timing, yet it appears to wander in the sky from the ground. Its daily track can look like a soft, elongated figure, rising and falling relative to the horizon, while returning to the same place each turn. The distinction between geosynchronous and geostationary paths is visible in the way antennas are used. A perfectly geostationary satellite can be served by a fixed dish. A geosynchronous satellite with a small tilt still returns to the same sky pattern each day, but the dish may need a little motion or a wider field of view. Designers choose the exact orbit based on the task. For a continuous relay, the circular equatorial path is simplest. For some scientific or regional purposes, a slightly inclined path may be acceptable if the timing is still useful. The needed height comes from the relation between gravity and orbital period. Gravity pulls a satellite inward. The satellite's sideways motion keeps that pull from becoming a straight fall. In a circular orbit, the inward pull is what bends the path into a closed curve. Farther from Earth, gravity is weaker and the orbit is larger, so the satellite moves more slowly and takes longer to complete one circuit. At low altitudes, an orbit takes only a short time. At greater distances, the period lengthens. Somewhere between low Earth orbit and the distance of the moon, the period becomes one sidereal day. This connection can be expressed with a rule that links the size of an orbit to the time needed to complete it. For any satellite circling Earth, the average distance from the planet's center sets the period. If the desired period is known, the distance can be calculated using Earth's gravitational strength and the length of the sidereal day. Scientists find an orbital radius of about 42,164 kilometers from Earth's center. Subtracting Earth's own radius gives an altitude of about 35,786 kilometers above the equator. At that height, the satellite travels at roughly 3.07 kilometers per second. The speed is quick, but the circle is so wide that one full trip takes nearly one turn of the planet. The idea was worked out through the ordinary tools of orbital mechanics. Astronomers measured Earth's rotation by watching stars. Physicists refined the value of Earth's gravitational pull. Mathematicians then asked what distance would give a chosen period, and the answer placed the orbit high above the atmosphere. Later, engineers studied how real spacecraft would behave there. They considered the slight flattening of Earth. They also accounted for the pull of the moon and sun, along with the gentle pressure of sunlight. None of these effects is large at that height. But over months and years, they can nudge a satellite away from its assigned place. Because of those small nudges, a geostationary satellite usually carries thrusters or other means of fine correction. Operators watch its longitude and latitude and make tiny adjustments when needed. These maneuvers keep the spacecraft near a chosen point in the sky. When a satellite is no longer needed at its assigned longitude, it may be moved to a slightly higher region reserved for an active spacecraft. This leaves the useful belt clear and keeps operations orderly. The longitude of a geostationary satellite is not arbitrary. Certain positions above the equator are more stable because Earth's equatorial bulge creates slight variations in the gravitational field. A satellite can drift toward preferred longitudes if left unattended. Operators account for this drift when planning fuel and when choosing where to place a spacecraft. This adds another layer of quiet order to the belt. The value of such a steady position is easy to see. A ground antenna can point toward one part of the sky and remain there. It does not need to follow a fast-moving object from horizon to horizon. This makes geostationary satellites useful for communications because a signal can be sent upward, then returned to a broad area below. The same geometry helps weather satellites watch clouds and daylight changes over a wide portion of Earth. Each image is taken from the same viewpoint, so slow changes in the atmosphere become easier to follow. From that height, a single satellite can see a large part of Earth's disk. It cannot look all the way to the poles because the planet curves away. Geostationary satellites therefore give their best view over equatorial and middle latitudes. Several spacecraft can be spaced around the equator so that different longitudes each have a steady viewpoint. The spacing is measured in degrees of longitude, and international agreements assign positions so signals do not crowd one another. The ring of these positions is often called the Clark Belt, after a writer who described how such an orbit could support communications. The name marks a simple path from thought to practice. The belt is not packed like a roadway, but useful locations are limited. Each satellite needs enough separation to avoid radio interference and to allow careful control. A Hohmann transfer orbit is an ellipse that connects two circular orbits around the same central body. It gives a spacecraft a smooth path from one steady orbit to another, while asking for the smallest change in velocity that two brief engine burns can provide. The idea belongs to orbital mechanics, where motion is governed by gravity and by the careful use of momentum in its simplest form. The transfer is quiet and orderly. A spacecraft already moving in a circular orbit fires its engine once, coasts along half of an ellipse, then fires its engine again to settle into the new circle. The shape of the transfer comes directly from the geometry of ellipses. One focus of the ellipse sits at the central body, such as a planet or the sun. The closest point of the ellipse, the periapsis, lies at the radius of the lower circular orbit. The farthest point, the apopsis, reaches the radius of the higher circular orbit. The spacecraft touches the lower circle at one end of the ellipse and the higher circle at the other. Because the two paths are tangent at those points, the spacecraft does not need to change direction sharply. It only needs to adjust speed. The first engine burn changes the spacecraft's speed just enough to place it on the ellipse. If the destination orbit is higher, the burn increases speed. The spacecraft then moves away from the central body, climbing against gravity, while its forward speed gradually decreases. During this coast, no further thrust is required. In the ideal picture, the vehicle follows the ellipse because gravity continuously bends its path. At the far side, the spacecraft is moving more slowly than a spacecraft already in the higher circular orbit. The second burn adds speed again, rounding the path into the new circle for a move to a lower orbit. The same pattern runs in reverse. The first burn reduces speed, so the spacecraft drops into an ellipse whose near point lies at the lower altitude. It coasts inward, gaining speed as gravity draws it closer. At the lower point, it is moving faster than a spacecraft already in that circular orbit. So a second small reduction in speed lets it settle into the lower circle. The transfer remains efficient because the engine is used only at the two points where the change in velocity produces the desired change in orbital energy. The efficiency of this method is measured in delta V, a term that means a change in velocity. Rocket fuel is limited, and every unit of delta V must be earned by pushing propellant out of the engine. A transfer that requires less delta V can carry less propellant, or it can use the available propellant for instruments, communication, or a longer mission. The Hohmann transfer is often the minimum delta V path between two circular coplanar orbits when the engine burns are treated as short, separate events. That condition is called the impulsive approximation. It imagines each burn happening quickly compared with the long coast along the ellipse. The idea was worked out by studying the conservation of energy and angular momentum in orbital motion. An orbiting body has both kinetic energy from its motion and gravitational potential energy from its position. A circular orbit has a fixed relationship between altitude and speed. An elliptical orbit spreads that relationship over a range of altitudes, with higher speed near periapsis and lower speed near apopsis. By choosing an ellipse that just touches the starting and ending circles, the transfer uses the natural exchange between speed and height. The mathematics can be expressed with the Viss-Vivre equation, which relates orbital speed to distance from the central body and to the size of the orbit. Walter Hohmann, a German scientist interested in spaceflight, presented this transfer as a way to move between planetary orbits with modest energy. His work helped show that travel between orbits could be planned with ordinary mechanics, using gravity as the main guide rather than constant thrust. The concept became a standard part of mission design because it gives a clear baseline. Planners can compare other paths against it, deciding whether a longer route or a different propulsion method might be better for a particular flight. Between planets, the transfer ellipse is drawn around the Sun rather than around a single planet. A spacecraft leaving Earth for Mars, for example, can enter an ellipse that touches Earth's orbit at one end and Mars's orbit at the other. The spacecraft must depart when the target planet will arrive at the meeting point at the same time the spacecraft does. This timing depends on the relative motion of the two planets. The needed alignment repeats at regular intervals, giving launch opportunities separated by predictable periods. The transfer itself is not a straight line through space. It is a curved solar orbit that lets the spacecraft fall gently outward or inward under the Sun's gravity. The same reasoning applies to satellites moving between circular orbits around Earth. A satellite in a low circular orbit can raise itself to a higher circular orbit by entering a transfer ellipse. The first burn occurs at the low orbit. The second burn occurs at the high point of the ellipse. Mission designers often describe this as two burns separated by a coast. The result is a smooth change in altitude without continuous thrust. If the satellite uses low thrust instead, it may spiral outward slowly, which is a different kind of transfer. The Hohmann path assumes brief burns and a long, unpowered arc. There are limits to the method. The orbits need to be nearly circular and in nearly the same plane for the simplest calculation to hold. If the starting and ending orbits are tilted relative to each other, a plane change may be needed, and that can require extra velocity change. If the destination is very far away, other paths may sometimes use less delta V, though they take longer. The Hohmann transfer remains a useful reference because it shows how much velocity change is needed for the most direct two-burn move. It gives a calm, economical shape to a problem that might otherwise seem open-ended. Fuel savings do not mean speed. A transfer to a higher orbit takes time, often half the period of the ellipse. For a journey between two planetary orbits, that coast can last many months. The spacecraft spends most of the trip moving without thrust, carried by the orbit it has already established. This slow steadiness is part of the method's character. It accepts a longer path in exchange for a smaller demand on the engine. In mission planning, patience and efficiency often go together. The transfer also shows how orbital motion is not a matter of pointing toward a destination and pushing forward. A spacecraft changes its future position by changing the shape of its path. A small increase in speed can raise the far side of the orbit. a small decrease can lower it. The vehicle does not fight gravity directly. It enters a curve that gravity already supports. This is why the Hohmann transfer feels so natural within orbital mechanics. It uses the central body's pull as part of the route. In practice, real missions add small corrections to the ideal path. Engines are not perfectly instantaneous, and orbits are not perfectly circular. Navigation teams measure the spacecraft's position and velocity, then make gentle adjustments if needed. These adjustments keep the transfer ellipse aligned with the intended meeting point. So the two planned burns remain the main changes to the path. A tidally locked body turns once in exactly the time it takes to complete one orbit. This keeps nearly the same hemisphere facing the object it circles. The familiar moon is a nearby example as it travels around Earth. The same lunar mountains and plains remain turned toward us, while the far side stays hidden from viewers on Earth. The body is still in motion. Its spin has settled into a steady match with its orbital path. The cause lies in the way gravity changes with distance. The side of a moon or planet that is closer to its partner feels a slightly stronger pull than the side farther away. That small difference stretches the body along the line, joining the two objects. In a solid body, the stretching is slight. In a body with oceans, ice, or a soft interior, the response can be larger. The result is a pair of gentle bulges, one toward the partner and one on the opposite side. If the body spins faster than it orbits, those bulges are carried a little ahead of the line between the centers. The partner then pulls on the nearer bulge with a force that acts against the spin. Over long stretches of time, that gravitational tug removes rotational energy. The spin slows. If the body spins too slowly, the bulges lag behind, and the tug can speed the rotation up. The tendency is to guide the spin toward the rate where one turn matches one orbit. The process depends on internal friction. Real materials are not perfectly rigid. They flex, warm slightly, and dissipate motion in small ways. Each orbit gives the body another chance to settle a little more. The change is slow by human standards. For objects close to their partners, the effect can become complete within the age of a planetary system. For distant objects, it may take much longer, or it may never finish. Distance matters strongly because tidal influence weakens rapidly as separation grows. A moon orbiting close to a giant planet experiences a steady shaping pull. Many such moons keep one face toward the planet. The same principle can apply to planets close to their stars. When a planet orbits very close to its star, the star's gravity can synchronize the planet's rotation with the year. In those cases, the rotation period and the orbital period become the same. Tidal locking is not always a simple one-to-one match. An orbit that is noticeably elliptical can lead to other stable arrangements. A body might rotate three times for every two orbits, keeping a pattern that repeats without being fully locked in the most familiar sense. Such resonances arise from the same tidal forces acting over many cycles. They show that the final state depends on orbit shape, internal structure, and the history of the body's spin. The moon offers a clear view of how this works in practice. Its rotation is synchronized with its monthly path around Earth from the ground. Observers see small rocking motions called librations. These happen because the moon's orbit is not a perfect circle, and because its axis is slightly tilted. Libration lets viewers glimpse a little beyond the usual edge over time. Still, the same broad hemisphere remains, turned toward Earth. The idea was worked out gradually through observation and mechanical reasoning. People noticed that the moon did not appear to turn relative to Earth. Later, gravitational theory showed how a small difference in pull could produce torques over long periods. Measurements of lunar motion and planetary satellites supported the picture. Studies of how materials flex under gravity added further support. The modern account treats tidal locking as a natural outcome of gravity acting on bodies that are not perfectly stiff. When a planet is tidally locked to its star, the geometry creates two lasting hemispheres. One faces the star in continual daylight. The other faces outward into space in continual night. Between them lies a band where the star stays near the horizon. This arrangement can produce extreme temperature differences. The day side receives steady light, while the night side radiates heat away without direct sunlight. The result is not uniform everywhere, because atmospheres and surfaces can move heat around. Atmosphere changes the picture. A thick atmosphere can carry warmth from the bright side toward the dark side. Winds can flow in steady patterns shaped by the fixed heating. Oceans, if present, can store heat and release it slowly. Ice can form where temperatures are low and remain stable over long periods. A locked world can therefore have a permanent day side and a permanent night side, with a transition zone between them. Without much atmosphere, the contrast can be sharper. Sunlit rock warms under constant illumination. Shadowed ground cools by sending infrared radiation into space. Some regions near the boundary between light and dark may stay in a narrow range of temperatures. Craters near the poles of a locked body can keep certain areas in deep shade, allowing cold traps to persist. These features are studied as part of the broader behavior of locked surfaces. Tidal locking also affects how a body experiences seasons. If the rotation is synchronized and the axis has little tilt, the pattern of light stays nearly fixed. There may be little seasonal change compared with a freely rotating world. If the orbit is eccentric, the distance to the star can vary, and the amount of received light can rise and fall during each orbit. The surface then experiences a slow breathing of brightness rather than a cycle of day and night. The phenomenon is common enough to be considered a quiet norm among close satellites. Many moons in the outer solar system keep one face toward their planets. Binary objects can lock to each other when their masses are similar enough and their separation is small. In such systems, both bodies may present the same hemisphere to one another as they move. The result is a shared rhythm, with each object's spin tied to the motion of the pair. For observers, tidal locking offers a useful way to think about rotation in space. A locked body remains in motion. it moves through its orbit and rotates at the same rate needed to keep its orientation aligned. The alignment emerges from patient physical processes rather than from any special adjustment. Gravity provides the direction. Internal friction provides the settling. Time provides the room for the motion to become steady. The temperature patterns on locked planets follow from that steadiness. One side is always lit, and the other is always dark. The atmosphere, or lack of atmosphere, decides how much heat crosses the divide. Scientists model these flows with equations for radiation and fluid motion. The models help describe where clouds might gather and where the coldest regions might lie. A stone tossed upward slows because the planet is quietly pulling it back. The pull is gentle at first, and it grows weaker with distance, but it never quite disappears. If the stone begins with only a modest upward speed, that pull will eventually pause its climb and draw it home. If it begins with enough speed, the pull becomes too weak to reverse the motion. The boundary between those two outcomes is called escape velocity. The threshold belongs to speed rather than location. It is the minimum speed an object would need at a given distance from a planet or moon to coast away without any further push. The idea assumes an ideal setting with no air resistance and no engine firings. It also sets aside tugs from other nearby bodies. In that simplified picture, gravity is the only force to consider, and the question becomes a matter of energy. An object near a planet has gravitational potential energy, though the phrase can sound more mysterious than it is. Potential energy here measures how much work gravity could do as the object moves. Close to the planet, the object is deep in a gravitational well. Moving farther away requires energy, just as walking uphill requires effort. Speed supplies energy too. The faster an object moves, the more kinetic energy it carries. Escape happens when the kinetic energy at the start is enough to pay for the climb out of the well. The mathematical expression for this threshold is compact. The needed speed equals the square root of 2 times the gravitational constant times the mass of the planet, divided by the distance from the planet's center. The symbols can be set aside, but the relationships are worth keeping. A more massive planet creates a deeper well, so the required speed is higher. Starting closer to the center also raises the required speed, because the object begins where gravity is stronger. Starting farther away lowers it. For Earth, the value near the surface is large. In a vacuum, ignoring the atmosphere, an object would need a speed of roughly 11 kilometers per second to coast away without additional thrust. That is faster than most everyday motions, but it is not a wall. Rockets do not have to reach that speed in a single instant. They can thrust continuously, adding energy little by little. If an engine keeps working, a spacecraft can move away from Earth, even while its momentary speed is below the coasting threshold. Escape velocity describes what would be needed if the engines fell silent and the craft simply continued on its own. This distinction makes the concept calmer than it may first appear. A spacecraft does not face a sudden test passed in a single moment. The concept is an accounting of total energy. A vehicle that receives steady thrust is not limited to the speed it happens to have at any one moment. It is accumulating the ability to climb farther. Once it has enough energy and then stops thrusting, it can continue outward. The required speed also changes with altitude. At a high mountain, the needed speed is slightly lower than at sea level, because the starting point is already farther from the planet's center. From a high orbit, it is lower still. This is one reason space missions care about where they begin their final push outward. A craft already far from a planet has less gravitational climbing left to do. Rotation can add a quiet assistance. A planet that spins gives objects on its surface a bit of sideways motion. If a launch moves in the same direction as that spin, the craft begins with some speed already provided by the rotating ground. The escape speed relative to the planet's center is unchanged, but the speed required relative to the ground can be a little less. The effect is modest, yet it is part of the complete picture. Smaller bodies have much lower thresholds. A moon with less mass holds a shallower gravitational well, so a spacecraft needs less speed to leave it. On a very small asteroid, the needed speed can be comparable to a slow hop. Large planets demand more. A gas giant, with its great mass, asks for a much higher coasting speed than a rocky world like Earth. The same rule applies everywhere, but the numbers shift with mass and distance. The concept was worked out by combining two broad ideas from classical physics. One is that gravity weakens with distance in a regular way. The other is that motion and position can be treated as forms of energy that trade back and forth. When those ideas are placed together, the threshold emerges naturally. No special machinery is needed beyond careful measurement of mass and distance. The result is a simple relationship that applies to planets and moons, and it can be extended to stars. In orbital language, escape speed sits just above the speed needed for a circular orbit at the same distance. For a perfectly round orbit, an object moves sideways fast enough to keep falling around the planet rather than into it. If the speed is increased, the path stretches into an ellipse. At the escape threshold, the path opens into a curve that does not return. With still more speed, the path opens wider. These shapes are graceful consequences of the same gravitational law. Air resistance complicates the picture near a planet's surface. A real launch through an atmosphere loses energy to drag. So vehicles usually rise carefully and gain speed as the air thins. The pure escape speed still matters, but it belongs to the vacuum part of the story. Once above most of the air, a craft can be compared to the ideal case. Another quiet detail is that escape velocity does not mean leaving gravity behind completely. Gravity extends outward without a sharp edge. A departing spacecraft always feels some pull, however faint. The threshold means only that the pull will never be strong enough to turn the craft around. The spacecraft may slow as it climbs, but it will keep moving outward. Its speed approaches a gentle limit rather than dropping to zero and reversing. The direction of the initial motion also matters in a practical sense. The speed threshold is about magnitude. But the path must not intersect the ground. An object fired straight down, even at escape speed, would not escape because it would strike the surface in space, away from obstacles. The direction can be chosen to suit the journey. The energy requirement remains the central fact. Night settles over the planet, and the sky becomes a quiet reminder that motion can be predictable. Earth turns at its familiar pace, carrying us toward darkness without any effort from us. The moon circles Earth because of our planet's gravity, while Earth follows its path around the sun because of the sun's pull. These motions continue in steady patterns while you rest. Your own body has rhythms too. Breathing slows, muscles soften, the mind lets the day's details drift apart like distant satellites passing beyond view. There is no need to steer anything now. Orbits do not struggle to remain in place, and you do not need to manage the night. You can rest inside the same quiet order that guides worlds around one another. Good night.